From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Carrie Gress, author of The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Carrie Gress in their conversation.
Talk a little bit about the lost girls, the girls that are broken and yet are the ones who set the table for feminism as we see it today.
You know, I looked back at all these women, Mary Wollstonecraft and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and, you know, certainly Kate Millett and others that came later. But 201, these were all incredibly broken women. They all had, you know, major areas in their life that needed healing or that needed some kind of resolution to. And the hard part is that rather than looking back and saying, you know, I just had horrible parents, the solution was, well, we just need to change parents, you know, which isn't the case in Mary Wollstonecraft's case. And so it was just what happened was this idea of always moving further left, further towards socialism, towards communism, towards libertine ideas to try and fix things without really recognizing the wreckage that would happen. So there was no sense of, you know, maybe we should go back to something like the Ten Commandments. And in fact, that was actually why a lot of this started, because around the time of the French Revolution, the Enlightenment thinkers had taken over, and much of their effort was to get rid of anything that was dependent upon the Bible for their reason and for action. And they wanted to get rid of the Ten Commandments entirely and anything related to the Bible. And so the way that they did that was this dependency on what they called reason and reasoning to, you know, why the way that man should act. So that's the real basis for a lot of these ideas, is just if they can get rid of tradition and break these taboos, then they can kind of create this utopia. And of course, time and again, all we see is things just getting worse because they're not working within the confines of human nature. And that, you know, just created all of these continual problems to the point where it's very hard to even figure out how to go back, because things have gone so far and gotten to be such a mess that it's hard to even imagine plugging back into our cultural ethos, these, you know, notions like the Ten Commandments and whatnot. So anyway, that's really what the lost girls have brought us, is these are the women that are, you know, incredibly broken. They shouldn't be anywhere near public policy. And yet they're the ones who have really dictated the way that women think in the world today.
You just mentioned the French Revolution, and that was a real seminal point in history for establishing a secular order in place of a spiritual order.
Yeah, no, and this is huge. I don't think we can really overstate how significant the French Revolution was in our way of thinking, especially when it comes to feminism, because that's Mary Wollstonecraft, who's considered the godmother of feminism. She's thinking right along, you know, the same terms as someone like Thomas Paine, who is called the first socialist, really. This idea of how do we get rid of any kind of hierarchy? How do we get rid of monarchy? How do we get rid of any kind of hierarchy or patriarchy in the church? And families, how do we get rid of the military? They just wanted this very flattened society, which, you know, we end up seeing, of course, an effort to make that in communism under the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet Union, this desire to get rid of all of these structures of humanity that had been built up over centuries. They're trying to get rid of all of them. And that's really the template that feminism followed moving forward, was, you know, getting to people to think more like Marxists, without any of these structures, instead of thinking, you know, along in any kind of biblical terms.
Yeah, you mention in your book, this is so poignant and profound, Mary Wollstonecraft, she rejected motherhood, and yet she became the mother of someone who wrote the gothic novel Frankenstein.
Yeah.
The way you cash that out in the book is great reading, but it's powerful because it's a harbinger of that which will come later on, which eventually happened in our generation, the mutilation of people.
Yeah, no, that was one of those insights. You know, when you're writing a book, you don't really always know what you're going to find and how things are going to fit together. And so it was pretty remarkable to look at someone like Mary Shelley, who, you know, Mary Shelley was married to Percy Shelley, who was a huge romantic, huge force for breaking down any kind of taboo. He also is curiously, you know, it was the one that came up with what I call the three pillars of feminism. It was in his work that that's what feminism became moving forward. And these ideas were free love, the occult, and smashing the patriarchy. He put all those things together in his work in what he called the women's revolution. So Mary Shelley then, and they're, both of them are fascinated by this idea of creating and creation and science and electricity, you know, all these kinds of new concepts. And so it's really interesting to see that she creates in the book Frankenstein this creature who ultimately is just this miserable, you know, just unloved creature. And, you know, in many respects, you know, people speculate that she was sort of putting herself in that because she probably felt a certain amount of guilt that her mother died after she was born. And, you know, she ran away from her father to be with Shelley before Shelley was divorced from his first wife. And anyway, there was just a mess in her life. So there's this desire to sort of create something out of nothing using technology. And of course, they didn't have the technology to do what we're doing today. And that's the amazing thing, is to see the lengths that people are going to sort of make themselves whole in the way that Mary Shelley probably longed for. It certainly is in the book of Frankenstein and the creature. And, you know, now we're seeing this with, you know, if we just change some body parts out, then somehow that's supposed to bring healing to what it is that people are really suffering, which of course will never bring healing to it. And this is why we see, you know, the fruits of it, that suicide levels are much higher after any kind of trans surgeries. And, you know, we also see it in feminism itself, just how miserable women are. And these are the statistics that most feminists will never talk about, just the rise in depressions, suicide attempts or successful attempts at suicide, substance abuse, divorces, all of these kinds of things are really pointing to incredibly unhappy people because, again, we're not working with human nature. We're working directly against it to create something of our own imagining.
You just mentioned the word romantic. What was the role that romanticism played in the advancement of feminism?
Oh, I think it was a huge, huge role. I mean, romanticism, of course, is reacting to the very sort of strict logic of many Enlightenment thinkers like Immanuel Kant. And the romantics wanted mystery. They wanted emotion. They wanted things that were sort of went against what they saw as very sterile logic. And Percy Shelley was absolutely, you know, a romantic poet who was trying to push taboos and sort of get out of anything that they considered, you know, archaic or just old. So yeah, I think that it was a huge influence, and we probably never would have gotten the feminism that we inherited without the romantic movement, because it also worked very much on the principles of emotion instead of on reason and logic or any kind of tradition. So yeah, I think it can't be overstated how much romanticism played into the movement itself.
And you look today at the relationship between the occult and the destruction of the patriarchy that you're talking about earlier, and that was part of what came out of the romantic movement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The occult was very much a vibrant element and certainly a piece of romanticism. Percy Shelley himself was hugely interested in it. And, I pulled a lot of these ideas from this actually Swedish thinker's work called Satanic Feminism, and it was published by Oxford University Press. An amazing work in the sense of just showing the role that the occult played, you know, during this time period. And it wasn't just one or two people. I mean, it was just widely spread and a very active part of feminism, especially if you move forward, you know, someone like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, she got a lot of her ideas from seances and using mediums, and was, you know, very involved in that second Great Awakening in the United States. But that part of it, that especially New York State, that was using a lot of, you know, rapping tables and whatnot to call on the demonic. So yeah, it's pretty amazing when I started digging into it, just to see, you know, wow, the occult is really a major piece in this. And it comes up again, of course, too, in the 60s and 70s. There's a book called The Sisterhood is Powerful that was hugely popular. It was a compilation of work by a woman named Robin Morgan, who I think is still alive. And in it actually has spells in the back of it, sort of for everyday use. So this was a major piece of it, because of course, the occult, and, you know, typically has always been a way to undermine men by women. You know, this is why there's always a female witch that gets a lot more airtime than I think wizards do, because women just saw this as a way to be powerful through witchcraft and through spells and the occult. And so this is why it returns over and over again throughout the movement.
And in recent generations, the personification of that is Madonna.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Absolutely. And so she's one, I mean, she even just recently, she did a photo shoot in Italy in the Italian Vogue that is featuring her as Christ at the Last Supper. And it's, I mean, the pictures are just horrifying to look at because, of course, there's 12 women who are supposed to be the apostles, and it's just awful. So yeah, she's certainly emblematic of that. But you can see it also in the ways in which most of the pop stars, I think Halsey just did one, maybe in the last 2 or 3 years, representing herself as the Virgin Mary. There's this sort of this goddess worship going on with women like Beyonce and whatnot. So it's become very popular in the pop world to have these women make themselves goddesses.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Carrie Gress. Feminism, the ideology dedicated to smashing the patriarchy, has made male lives the norm for everyone. In a powerful new book, Carrie Gress says what cannot be said. Feminism has abolished women. From the serpent seduction of Eve to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, to Kate Millett's lust, violence, and insanity, to Meghan Markle's havoc-ridden rise to royalty, Dr. Gress presents a history as intriguing as the characters who lived it. The answers women most desperately need are to be found precisely where they are most afraid to look. Only a rediscovery of true womanhood and motherhood can pull our society back from the brink. To receive your copy of The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us by Carrie Gress, call us at 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
If you thought the pandemic was scary, it may actually pale in comparison to today's pandementia. We're talking about wokeism and its growing legions of followers who have defiantly and dangerously declared their independence from reality. That's right. For those infected by the woke virus, anytime their ideology encounters reality, ideology wins. To help halt the advance of this deadly social and mental disease, you'll want a copy of the upcoming special edition of the Christian Research Journal. In it, you'll feast on penetrating analyses and criticisms of one of the most dangerous ideologies in modern history, all written to help you grasp just how deranged this tyrannical movement actually is. To receive your copy, visit equip.org, that's equip.org, or call 888-7000-CRI, that's 888-7000-CRI.
Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do. Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now.
Again, that's equip.org. Let's now rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Carrie Gress, in their conversation.
There's this sort of this goddess worship going on with women like Beyonce and whatnot. So it's become very popular in the pop world to have these women make themselves goddesses, actually. So it's really tucked in so many remarkable places that you don't expect. And once you start seeing it, it's everywhere. I just wrote a piece a few months ago about, you know, why I can't shop at Barnes & Noble anymore, because it feels like every part of the store is touched in some way with the occult, whether it's products or books or, you know, especially in the children's section, you know, the areas where you don't want your children, you know, dabbling into any kind of occult activity. It seems like it's just everywhere. So yeah, I think it's been very subtle, but now it's kind of out in the open in terms of our culture. TV shows, movies, all of that is really not afraid of it as a topic anymore.
I think of Elizabeth Stanton or Susan B. Anthony, and you think these are wholesome feminist women. You paint the other side of the story.
Yeah, no, I thought that too. And when I started looking at this, I thought, okay, I'll spend a couple of days researching this. I'm sure I'll find some great quotes I can at least pull to show, you know, that first wave feminism was actually good. And I was just amazed. Yeah, I think that Elizabeth Stanton was really crafty. I think she, you know, talking about branding, she did an amazing job of making herself really the center of the suffrage movement. So much so that even the Seneca Falls Convention that people talk about as sort of the start of the suffrage movement, the women's movement, she painted Susan B. Anthony into that story, even though they didn't even know each other at that point. But Susan B. Anthony, they met later, and Susan B. Anthony was single. So she ended up becoming really a voice, you know, the mouthpiece of Katie Stanton, because Elizabeth was home with her children and couldn't travel the way that Susan B. Anthony could. But basically what ended up happening was that Elizabeth Cady Stanton did so many things that she shut down the suffrage movement for about 30 years. She was even thrown off the board of her own organization, partially because she wrote this book called The Women's Bible, which is a commentary on Old and New Testament. And it uses all these ideas of atheism, of theosophy, which was this sort of cobbled together new age religion by this Russian noblewoman, Madame Blavatsky. And Katie Stanton never really called herself an adherent, but she had many of her friends who were involved in the book were adherents to theosophy. So you can see elements of that in her Women's Bible. But the other thing was they got very much involved in this scandal with this woman named Victoria Woodhull, who, by the way, Gloria Steinem had a picture of Victoria Woodhull in her office, you know, how many years later, 60, 70 years later, maybe more. But Victoria Woodhull was named by the press Mrs. Satan because she had been a medium her whole life, and she was very much into free love. And she was just this indomitable spirit on the scene in New York City. And so Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were upset they weren't getting enough press. And so they had her come be a speaker. And, you know, this just created all kinds of chaos, because then it was finally figured out that there was this big scandal at the heart of it. And anyway, this infighting and this scandal, which I go into in the book, but it's way too detailed to talk about here, that really, you know, got their reputation was destroyed, and they were, you know, no longer in any way really involved in the suffrage movement. And that's why suffrage didn't happen for another, you know, 30 years after the demise of their effort. But nobody really knows that. I mean, I think most of us think of suffrage and we think of those two, and we don't think of anybody at 1919 and who was involved then. I mean, we just have the sense that these two women were really the cornerstone of it. And we have this impression that they were just these great noble women fighting for something really good, but without really knowing any of the much more colorful trimmings of their lives.
Yeah, Elizabeth Stanton in particular. I mean, you can talk about Susan B. Anthony and being minted and all that, but Elizabeth Stanton I find so interesting. She grew up as a strict Calvinist, and then she becomes the priestess of feminism in the sense of inventing a new trinity. So instead of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you have feminism, spiritualism, and hypersexuality.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, we don't know that much about Susan B. Anthony at this point. One of her biographers spent 4 days burning her letters, her papers, any of her correspondence, anything that she had left, which, you know, of course, begs the question, why would a biographer do that? Most biographers, you know, hang on to that stuff and make sure that these things are saved for the future. So there's a lot of gaps in our understanding of Susan B. Anthony's life. Although, you know, at certain points, I know she was engaged in the spiritualism. She actually made some statement about how she just wishes that when she spoke publicly, the spirit would just take her over so that she didn't have to do the actual work of it. So anyway, yeah, it's really remarkable to start looking behind the curtain a little bit and see this was not some sort of purist movement, but it just had, you know, so much baggage associated with it.
Yeah, talk about Stanton's Declaration of Sentiments. That's based on the Declaration of Independence, and it produces what is arguably the greatest revolution the world has ever known.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that happened at her spirit table. She had this idea for, she was doing this convention, and she didn't know how to make it something bigger than it was. She wanted to make it, like you said, it's a huge revolution. So, you know, presumably it's with the help of the spirits, she decides to sort of mimic the Declaration of Independence, and she calls it this Declaration of Sentiments. But curiously, she doesn't really even know what women should be complaining about. You know, the big thing is, of course, the suffrage piece, and that was something that she was very focused on. She had a lot of resentment that actually colored men would have the capacity to vote before she did, and that her racism actually is what splintered the suffrage movement into two different groups. But, you know, there's this great story about how she's spending all this time trying to figure out what the grievances are, you know, that women should have towards men. And she finally has to ask, I think it's her husband and the husband of a good friend, well, what would middle-class women be upset about, or poor women be upset about? How do we articulate this? Because she was so wealthy and sort of, you know, protected from all of these realities, she didn't even know how to articulate it herself. And of course, the friend's husband jokes about how, you know, these grievances must be really great. If you can't come up with them, you need us to come up with them instead of yourself. So, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on that Stanton obviously, you know, pressed into to make her movement feel like it was, you know, much more significant than it really was.
You sort of hinted at this, but elaborate on the connection between abolitionism and feminism.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting, another one of those cycles that we see, because of course, abolitionism was happening. You had a lot of people that were abolitionist, and then they sort of hitched their wagon of feminism onto abolitionism, you know, kind of making the comparison that skin color is the same as sex and whatnot. And, you know, this should sound very familiar to all of us, because this is the exact same thing that happened in the 1950s and 60s with the civil rights movement, because again, you see this rise in feminism. But not only that, in that era, you also see the rise of the gay and lesbian movement. And actually, the gays specifically changed the language of their own movement to make themselves victims, you know, victim minorities, the way that women already had. And this is how they were so successful in sort of changing public opinion, was by changing the narrative about their own behavior. And that was just a really key piece. One of the interesting things that I did not put in the book, though, was that in the 1940s and 50s, there was a woman named Susan B. Anthony II, who was actually the niece of the first Susan B. Anthony. She was very involved in this communist group called the Congress for American Women. And, you know, people were just amazed that she was able to articulate so clearly, you know, what the women's grievances were and connecting it with abolition and with the African-American efforts for equal rights. And it was interesting to see this because, of course, all she had to do was go back and read what her aunt had written. You know, it was the same, almost the same kind of rhetoric that was being used. And of course, this time she's, Susan B. Anthony II is really couching it within the Marxist framework instead of, you know, what they were using previously, which was not Marxist, but had much more egalitarian type of language, a little bit less stark than the communist language. But it's interesting to see just these patterns of, you know, all these things that you see in the 1800s, they come back, you know, almost on steroids at a later stage and are just much more powerful in the 60s and 70s because of everything that's happening socially and the Cold War and, you know, all kinds of things going on.
I was watching something recently. I can't place it in my mind right now, but a popular show, and the feminine mystique by Betty Friedan was brought up. And I thought, wow, this is a book that even if people haven't read, they know the title of.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can ever overestimate the impact that book had. In 1963, it comes out, 3 million copies are sold within years. And, you know, it's an amazing piece of work because you just see Betty Friedan was just masterful at really speaking to the woman's heart and trying to use that against us to, you know, lead us to her own ideology that she was focused on. And, you know, there's a great book by Daniel Horowitz that exposes the communist roots of Betty Friedan. Ironically, he's not trying to expose it for negative reasons. He actually thinks, you know, this is kind of amazing. Here was this communist woman that was able to hide her communism in the time of McCarthy and still be very successful in getting communist ideas and new left ideas populated in the culture. So he sees that as this, you know, just great act of defiance. And of course, I gobbled up much of that and found, you know, other sources corroborating it. But she was very much a communist. She had been, you know, since she was even late in high school, but certainly in college, very connected to this organization I already referred to, the Congress for American Women, which was, you know, disbanded by the House Committee for Un-American Activities back in 1949, I think, because it was such a piece of propaganda for the Soviets to really get in the minds of women.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Carrie Gress. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us by Carrie Gress. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more.
If you're not horrified, you should be, because the relentless assaults of wokeism on sanity and common sense have now reached a fevered pitch. In fact, some astute observers see more than deranged ideologies at work. It's as though the gates of hell have been opened. And alarmingly, the speed of this mindless rush to chaos and potential civilizational collapse is gaining momentum daily. That means Christians need to wake up and wake up fast. One of the best alarm clocks is the upcoming special Woke edition of the Christian Research Journal. It contains sobering articles with penetrating analyses of a social disease that is reaching a flashpoint. To receive your copy of this special edition of the Christian Research Journal, visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI.